Hilary Mantel joins us now for the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. We're discussing Bring Up the Bodies, which won the 2012 Man Booker Prize and is the second book in her series following Thomas Cromwell, an advisor to Henry VIII. The novel picks up where Wolf Hall left off and traces the downfall of King Henry's second wife, Anne Boleyn, after she'd failed to give him a son. Wolf Hall, which also won the Man Booker Prize in 2009, tells the story of Henry VIII's split from the Catholic Church and the annulment of his first marriage so that he could marry Anne Boleyn. These novels have been called stunning, dazzling, and the finest works of historical fiction in contemporary literature. They're both available in paperback from Picador, and I'm very pleased to welcome Hilary Mantel to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
We also hope that many of our listeners have read the books along with us. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org or write us on Facebook or Twitter. So why Thomas Cromwell? What is it about him that made you want to tell these events through him?
His story, it's such an irresistible trajectory. He starts off as a blacksmith's son, and he ends up as the Earl of Essex. It's a trajectory that ought not to be possible in Tudor England. So you have to ask, what kind of man was this? How did he manage it? How did he manage to get so close to the king that for 8 years he's the second most important man in England? I just wanted to know what fired him and what qualities you needed to make that leap from the bottom to the top of society.
Does it suggest that the class system wasn't as rigid at that time as we tend to think?
It had always been possible for a poor boy to get on if he was clever. But the system was you did it through the church. You got yourself ordained, you got to Oxford or Cambridge, and then if you were clever and lucky, you went into the service of a nobleman, and hence perhaps into the service of the king. But Cromwell was an exception because he wasn't a churchman. He didn't take this path. What he's doing is, it's not absolutely unprecedented, but the power he accretes is unique.
Although he does rise through the help of a major clergyman, Cardinal Wolsey.
Yes, he does. Wolsey was a butcher's son. Though his family were reasonably well off and savvy enough to think of sending their clever boy to university. So he was, if you like, a cut above Cromwell, socially speaking. Wolsey had come up in the service of Henry VII. Then he took over the affairs of the young king, Henry VIII, and became a major figure on the European stage as a diplomat, papal legate in England, boss of everything, really. You wouldn't have thought there was room for Cromwell to surpass him, but in a sense he did, because once he was in government, he was second man in both the church and state.
What was Cromwell's reputation in England before you started working on these books? Is he someone who's taught in history classes?
To historians, over the last, three decades, I would say, his reputation is as, a man of great quality, a radical, a man remarkable for his innovation in government. But the popular perception of him hasn't caught up with what the historians think. So we know him through plays like A Man for All Seasons, in which he's the big villain, and we know him through popular fiction. And again, he's always wearing a black cloak, plotting something in the shadows. I thought we could do better than this. I thought that we needed something a little bit more nuanced, a little bit more complex, as a portrait of this man. So my idea was to coax him out of the shadows and turn the spotlight full on him. Now, people are reevaluating, they're rethinking. And his reputation, I'm pleased to say, is on the rise, which means really that we're just doing justice. We're just taking a fresh look at a man who's been very much maligned.
Can you talk about how you approach historical facts when you're writing fiction? Many of the questions that readers have left on our website have to do with research. How much research did you do, and how does it shape the story you want to tell?
I put a great deal of energy and effort into research, but I don't think of it as separate from the writing. I don't think you can do all your research and say, oh, okay, I've done my 3 years, I put that aside, now I begin to write. Because until you come to a particular point in your story, you don't know what you need to know. My method really is to amass as much as I can from the sources. And then when I come to a particular scene, I go back and revisit it all, along with all the secondary sources, the historians' accounts, and my own notes. And then with this all into my head, I dive into the scene. I do put a great deal of stress on reading the contemporary records, not always knowing at the time how I'm going to use them, but the particular scene drives you to pluck something out of the air, something that you read 5-6 years ago, some tiny little detail that will bring the whole thing to life. I think research isn't about quantity, it's about quality. And it's about isolating for the reader the tiny telling detail that illuminates motif or character, or just shows how different the Tudors were from us.
We often have Cromwell writing or reading, and you describe the piles of papers in his office. Do any of those papers still exist?
Yes, he's very well documented in an official and political sense, because he was a kind of letter-writing factory. He and his clerks generated endless quantities of paper. Now, of course, those papers, his own letters, went all over Europe. And there's a lot of luck in whether they were saved and preserved or not. But everything that came into him, he filed. And when he was arrested, when he finally fell from power, all those chests full of papers were taken away to the Tower of London, where they remained unsorted until Victorian times, and then the scholars got amongst them. So his official existence is very well documented. What's missing is the private man, because he was not a man who went in for a great deal of self-revelation. His letters are largely impersonal. Just occasionally, you get a flash of personality, a flash of passion, a flash of something that illuminates the writer. And as a researcher, you live on those moments. You have to do a lot with a very little.
I'm talking with Hilary Mantel, who has written two of the three books of her trilogy about Cromwell. The one we're discussing is Bring Up the Bodies, the subject of this month's Leonard LoPage Show Book Club. Rita from New Rochelle left this comment on our show page: without the charts at the beginning of the books, I would have been lost. A map would also be helpful. Do you need a chart of characters to help you keep everyone straight as you're writing?
Oh, well, I think I did at first. I keep a code index to keep tabs on where the characters are, where they're moving about geographically, so I don't put them in England when they're in Calais or vice versa. I think the family trees, all that stuff, is by now pretty well there in my head, but it is complex, you know, it takes time. I hadn't thought of a map, but, you know, that's a good pointer. I mean, I'll talk to my publisher. Maybe we should put a map in the third volume, maybe not just of England, but of Europe, which had considerably different frontiers, of course, from now. Thank you.
How close are you to completing the third volume?
Well, you know, I'm not meaning to sound Weasley here, but I don't write consecutively. So I can never say I'm a third of the way through. I can only say something like, I need another 18 months. And while it's absolutely lovely to think that readers are eager for it, I'm also determined not to be rushed. Because I know these three novels, they're the climax of my life's work. I know they're what I was meant to write. And if I can bring everything home in the third volume, then everything is right with me.
Do you know how you'll... I'm sorry. Do you know how you'll end it? Will you stop short of the tragic end?
No, we have to go there. It would be false because the whole story is filtered through Thomas Cromwell's consciousness. And I will take you to the very last moments of his life as his consciousness ebbs. That's the thing I do know about the end of the book. I know the beginning, I know the end. A lot of what's in the middle is to be negotiated. What I want to do, you see, is to draw in the other two books. Obviously, I have to carry a lot of backstory, but I don't want to repeat anything. I want to give the reader the information, but approach it from another angle. So that if there were one mighty reader who was really committed and said, I'm going to read these books from beginning to end, book one to book three, then it would all read like one enormous book. That's the way I'm trying to fix it. And obviously, it's pretty demanding. I think I was born for the epic.
We have a call from Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi, Nina. You're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Hello, Hilary.
Hello.
Thank you for your brilliant, brilliant novels. My question is, Cardinal Wolsey tells Thomas Cromwell to notice what people wear underneath. I think you undress your characters by dressing them. Could you tell us a little bit about how you brilliantly use garments to bring out the personality of your characters?
That's really interesting because, you know, there's a kind of historical fiction where there's a huge concentration on what the characters wear because the writer needs to show you all her research, you know. So First she puts on her lappet and then she puts on her tippet and then she pulls on her biggins and you know the kind of thing. And I wanted to, I suppose, just send up that little convention by having the cardinal say, well, you have to think what people wear under their clothes, sometimes a hair shirt. But clothes are one of the denoters of status. It's somewhere people put their money. And these clothes, I mean, in Thomas Cromwell's will, which is made quite early before he's a famous man, he tells you where all his coats have got to go. You know, my best coat, my second best coat, my green coat. They're all left to someone. And it seemed to me clothes never went away. The fabrics were so precious. They got taken apart and they got incorporated into other garments or into upholstery. So no one's ever quite dead. The body may be gone, but the clothes hang around after them.
Thank you for your call. We'll take a call now from Sarah from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thank you. Hello, Hilary.
Hello.
One of the things I admire in your books is the way you make people speak in an ordinary way and the way the ordinary people speak. And I wonder how much research you do into that around the political characters you write about too.
If I can get exact words, or words that are reported in documents, then I will use them and incorporate them into my text. And that means I've got to smooth my own dialogue into them. For instance, when Anne Boleyn was in the Tower, everything she said was written down, recorded, and sent to Thomas Cromwell within the hour. So it's really exciting to read that stuff. You know, you're getting exact words, maybe a little error in the reporting, but you are hearing Anne Boleyn speak. So I grab those moments and use what I can. I think you have to privilege clarity of communication. And if I reproduced early Tudor speak accurately, then my readers would be baffled. So I have to find a compromise. What I try to do is go for something clear, idiomatic, but at the same time, just put a little twist on it so that every so often the reader is nudged and made aware that these are not our contemporaries. They speak slightly differently and they think very differently.
Anne Boleyn comes across as a formidable character. How did she and Cromwell view each other?
At first, they were close allies. But Anne had been complicit in the downfall of Wolsey, Cromwell's mentor. And I think this was something Cromwell never forgot. Whether he forgave her in his own mind, we can't know. But certainly it was in the interests of both of them to work together. The man who was on his way up through the political process, and the woman the king was in love with, because Anne was sympathetic to reformed religion, so was Cromwell. By throwing in their lot together, they gained a great deal. But then at some point, relations sour, and I've tried to locate these moments and try to work out where it is that things go wrong between them. In the end, it's less personal, perhaps, than political. Once Henry's affection for Anne begins to wane, it becomes important that the marriage has never been accepted by the great powers of Europe. Other countries don't recognise it. They think Catherine was the real wife, Anne is the concubine. And so there comes a point when Henry wants rid of her, and Anne Boleyn becomes a political liability to Cromwell. And at that point, I'm afraid she's doomed.
But they don't bring back Catherine. You have a character saying to Cromwell, "You don't talk to women, do you?" What would be the subject?
That's the Duke of Norfolk, who in real life is on the record as having I had a conversation with his own daughter when she was round about 20 years old. And he said, "You know, she has a good wit, but I never talked to her about any matter before." So this is the Duke of Norfolk, you know, puzzling about why would you bother talking to women? And what would you possibly talk to them about? Cromwell, I don't want to take him out of his time, but he was much less of a misogynist than many of the men around him, Norfolk being a prime example. Cromwell spoke, both in the case of Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn, he paid tribute to their intelligence and their spirit. And there were many women among his correspondents. So we can say that, you know, he was someone who did know that when you talk to a woman, just treat her as an equal human being.
Well, talk about women in this country. Henry VIII is most likely to, just mentioning him, to lead to a discussion of his numerous wives, maybe some talk about the creation of the Church of England. But he was responsible for many important changes in the way that England was run. Was Cromwell behind many of those changes?
He was behind a great deal of innovation. Yes, chiefly because when Henry broke with Rome, Cromwell did it through a huge program of lawmaking. And the whole of the English Reformation was therefore set into statute law. And this tended to increase the importance of Parliament. Cardinal Wolsey had just called Parliament when he wanted to raise a tax. Cromwell called a Parliament to engineer the Reformation, and he kept it in session for almost 6 years, and he kept it busy too. So whilst the king is still an absolute monarch, you do have this other force, which, you know, it will never go away. Once you've given Parliament that sort of importance, you're not going to go backwards.
And then, of course, Elizabeth inherits that whole reforming sensibility and transforms England even more.
Yes, indeed.
Jeb from Williamsburg wrote us, in the first two novels of the series, I was struck by the ways in which the afterlife and the supernatural intertwined with the everyday consciousness of the characters, particularly Thomas Cromwell's. Can you discuss how this sense of the everyday spiritualism and the pre-Christian pagan legends of England shaped the worldviews of these characters?
There's a wonderful book with a rather dry title. It's called Religion and the Decline of Magic. It's by wonderful historian Keith Thomas. This is a book that I've never been able to keep on my shelves because I just give it to people saying, read this book. Somehow it's imbued with the sense of that earlier world, the pre-Reformation world, where magic and religion run together. And this pre-modern sensibility is what I wanted to infuse my novels with. People don't wake up in the morning and say, oh, it's the Reformation, I'll be rational now. They trail their childhoods with them. They trail the things they were told as little children, the stuff their grandmothers believed. And there is a very fine line between religious feeling and magical thinking. And I tried to make my narrative walk that line. And of course, I'm very concerned with their sensibility where religion is central. Everybody believes there is another life and that it's more important than this one. That makes them so different from moderns. And of course it was a pervasive belief throughout society, so I wanted every page to remember that these people are working on two different planes, the one where we see and feel and experience, and the religious plane, the hereafter, the scale of eternity.
Now, we don't have a lot of time, but a few listeners have wondered why you called the first book Wolf Hall, the name of the Seymour's home, when they didn't even figure into the story yet.
It's a bit of a tease, really. Well, Wolf Hall does get mentioned at several points during the narrative. And it's where they are going. The very last words of the book, Cromwell is plotting the king's summer holiday for him. And he says that they have 5 days spare in September. And where will we go? We'll go and see the Seymours at Wolf Hall. So it's a book that I'm shooting it like an arrow right through to those last words and the importance of Wolf Hall. becomes magnified in the second book when Jane Seymour is lined up to become wife number three. But I couldn't resist, you know, the metaphorical overtones of it. Everywhere that Henry is Wolf Hall. And I have Cromwell think about the saying, man is wolf to man, which very much sums up the predatory atmosphere of that court.
Now, Leanne from Manhattan left this comment on our show page. After I read the books, I went to the Frick Collection to see the Holbein portraits of Sir Thomas More and Thomas Cromwell. And the book and the paintings together make me feel like I really know these people. I love the part of the first book about the portrait when Cromwell says that Holbein makes him look like a murderer. You had that, and then you have another listener wondering about whether you watched The Tudors and whether you think that it took too many liberties, including having Henry VIII have all those ripped abs.
Yeah, well, when you cast a tiny little Irishman as Henry, you've already deviated so far from the truth.
He looked more like Charles Laughton, didn't he?
Not in his youth. He was very handsome, but he looked nothing like Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. It was curious, you know, the decisions they made. Very entertaining. But you see, I believe that you can stick close enough to the truth. You can be accurate, but you can also make good drama. The truth's always more interesting.
Hilary
than
Mantel,
you can invent.
The show, our Leonard Lopate book club selection was Bring Up the Bodies. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.